Hello, everyone. Hello, Ahdaf.
Hello, Amar.
This is a really fantastic start to our year, and it's a great honor to have Ahdaf with us tonight. She's leaving in 2 days. She's had just how many days have you been here? And she's been very generous with her time to come and launch the book again for the third time this week at the Mosaic Rooms.
This is the real one.
I've got some housekeeping information for you just before we start. There's a list of some changes to our spring program, our winter spring program, which we've included in the small leaflet on your chairs. And I also was asked to announce that tomorrow at 6 o'clock there is a concert, a fundraising concert for the refugees of the Syrian conflict, of the Syrian oppression, who are in the south of Turkey and the north on the border of Syria, that is organized by a group of young people here tomorrow at the Wesley's Chapel City Road. The Trio Khoury, who are Paris-based, a Palestinian, I think, or Palestinian-Syrian, brilliant trio apparently, are performing tomorrow, so I urge you to go to that. Now, we're going to have a conversation, then a short surprise, a technologically challenging one, and then some questions and answers, and obviously the bar will stay open and the bookshop is open for anyone who's interested in this book or indeed any other of Ahdaf's. And I'm going to be asking some questions. I haven't told Ahdaf any of my questions. She was very bravely set out. She was all right with being surprised.
Well, I hinted that it might be better to tell me, but it didn't happen, so there we are.
Okay, so we have literature in the midst of revolution. And what literature, indeed? I mean, you have a very ambitious work here which combines testimony, your personal history, your personal relationship to Cairo, and a history of the city as well. And at the same time, it is structured in quite an ambitious way, considering how little time you had to actually write it. You start with a sort of diary of the first 18 days of the uprising, starting 25th of January 2011. Then you stop. And then you have a pause, which is, I think, 9 months later.
No, not quite. I mean, sort of, I think it's October. Yeah, I suppose it is, really, because it's October.
9 months later, and then you go back.
Yeah.
Why did you structure it in this way? Or maybe tell us a bit more about the book for those of you who haven't read
Okay, well, as the preface says, which you will no doubt get to read, I many years ago, about 15 years ago, maybe longer, I signed a contract to write a book about Cairo. And it was meant to be like my Cairo, not a historical account of the city, but a personal account of the city. And I didn't do it. I collected a third of the advance and lived on it. But I did not write the book. And it was really difficult because what was happening was that I was feeling the city slip away from me. Every time I went back, there would be something, you know, some beautiful thing would have gone, some horrible thing would have been built, and the city was slipping away. So then when the revolution happened and I was writing dispatches for The Guardian from Tahrir Square, Alexandra, my publisher and friend, called me and said, I think this is the moment for your book on Cairo. And of course it was, but it was also a very scary idea because of the responsibility and also because it meant that I would have to sort of focus, sit down and concentrate rather than be active in the revolution, be on the streets. So anyway, eventually, by the time I actually got around to doing it, it was about August. And I had some notes, and I had the pieces I'd written for The Guardian, which turned out like I couldn't actually use them because, and then I was in a very different place. We all were, so it was very clear that you had to write the 18 days. I mean, you know, that had to be written. But at the same time, there we were. A lot had happened, and we were in a different place. So And then you had a third place, which was the place we are now, when the reader was actually going to get the book in their hands and read it. So how were you going to write the 18 days and make them continue to be relevant rather than just sort of some wonderful thing that happened and is now over, as the military would like us to believe, you know, and let's wrap it in cellophane and put it on the sideboard, you know, and that's it. So you want to bring it in and you want it to be relevant. And the way to do that, I thought, was to actually, write what was then the present as well, and hope that by doing that you were helping the reader to draw a line from the 18 days through to the summer, through to October, and then through to the point at which they were actually reading the book. Doing it with that interruption thing, that was the... that took a really long time to come up with it. I tried lots of different ways of doing it. Mainly, I wanted to end on a moment of triumph. I wanted to end on Mubarak leaving. On that note, and so eventually,
But you so you decided that you needed more than testimony, more than documenting. You needed to step back, almost in a Brechtian way, to take distance with what you were writing. But what seeps in is not analysis. It's actually very personal. It's very emotional. It's your Cairo. It's your Egypt. Why did you decide to bring that in? And is that something that distinguishes your work from... Because I've met a lot of writers and artists who are in crisis. They don't know how to respond to the events. And I thought your solution was extremely interesting. Why did it take you so long to come up with it?
No, the interruption was what took a long time to work out that basically what the book does is it starts with part one is called 18 days. January 25 to February the 11th. And then I think on February the 1st, it breaks off and it says an interruption. And then it says, well, actually, here we are now, sort of many months later. And the reason I'm interrupting my text is da 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 da, and so on. And then eventually it goes back and picks up and says the 18 days resumed. So it was that structure that took, you know, that took time to work out. But the mix of the personal and the public was just really the only way I could write this book. It was very much how it happened, how the revolution impacted me and everybody around me. It was highly personal, and also highly public. And that was what. And also another thing was that it seemed to me, and that was something I really wanted to do. It seemed to me that when we stood in Tahrir and defended it. We were aware of the significance of every building around us. We were aware of where every road led. We knew that there were three statues in Tahrir, Abdul Menem Riyad, Simon Bolivar, and Omar Makram. And that all these things gave an added emotional charge to what we were doing and to what was happening. And these significations were not available to somebody who was not Egyptian or not Cairene or didn't know the city. And I wanted that also to be shared because the impact of the revolution was very much shared. We very, very much felt, you know, the vibes and the waves coming from the world. And so really, it felt like the right thing to try and share everything that it meant to us with the reader.
That's absolutely, and you did that fantastically. The personal, the historical... And can we just go back to this idea of your writer's block? Because you start with a preface saying, I've been more or less in writer's... I mean, I've been trying to write this novel, and somehow these events, this idea that your editor came up with, unblocked what I... It's almost as if you were waiting for this moment to happen. Do you think that this revolution... Did you think before that you had a kind of crisis of subject matter that in fact, a lot of artists and writers about the region, from the region, didn't know what to say? There was such horror and such immobility.
No, not really, no. I knew what I wanted to say. And, in fact, I was working on a novel. But the thing is that... one is very easily distracted. And because of the circumstances of our part of the world, because of what happens in Egypt, what's happening in Palestine all the time, because of the kind of geographical, cultural location that one finds oneself in, there's always something that takes precedence. So you have a novel and you're working on it, but something has happened today and The Guardian would like a piece, and therefore you have that platform, you have that obligation to produce that piece. And so you produce the piece, and then something else happens, and then somebody calls you. And before you know it, 2 weeks have passed, and you're right out of the world of the novel that you're trying to create. And so then it takes you another 3 or 4 days to get back into it. Do you have that 3 or 4 days? Is it not a bit kind of, you know, a bit kind of, not quite a luxury, but a bit self-indulgent to say, well, I'm actually just going to sit in silence for 3 days in order for the novel to resurface?
Yeah, but so it that feels like it's been there a long time. What you, the energy in the book, although there's obviously a lot of immediate documenting and testimony and so on, there is a depth and energy that seems to go back to many years. And you really insist on the family history that I mentioned, even the history of the buildings, the architectural history of your town, and the history, obviously, of Egypt. And I find that that gives it a significance beyond the newsworthy, if you like. It must have been there. Is your novel going to be written in that spirit?
I hope so. I mean, I take what you mean about... the novel, I hope to go back to it very, very soon. Yani, inshallah, ya Rabbi, ya Rabbi, ya Rabbi. Yani. Yeah. And... because actually, I mean, the characters are alive, and the novel is conceived. It just has to be written. So yeah. It would be really, yani, really haram, yani, if I don't do it. So
we think so too.
But about about the energy and about how it was all there. I mean, do you mind? May I kind
Please.
Of?
We want you to read some.
Okay, because this issue of there's something that's there and comes pouring out because suddenly there's the arena for it. So this is a bit about the city itself, and it's let me see now. Okay, I can skip this one. Okay, this is about. It starts with like being based in London, and then Cairo, London, London, Cairo, and then it sort of actually says why it was impossible to write before, and I think that it'll really illustrate what you're saying. Cairo, London, London, Cairo. And Cairo was being constantly downgraded, despite the new luxury multi-purpose blocks, the marble shopping malls, the $15 million apartments, the city was disintegrating. Streets were dug up and left unpaved. Prime and historic locations, like the site of the burned-down opera house just off Ataba, became car parks. Streetlights dimmed. Old houses were torn down and monstrous towers built in their place. Public transport became a joke. And in a noose around the city, they built luxury gated communities on virtually stolen land, adorned them with water-guzzling golf courses, and called them European countryside and Beverly Hills. And through it all, I loved her and loved her more. Millions of us did. We'd wake up one morning and find a just-finished underpass dug up again, more marble and ceramics brought in to line its walls. We'd check out which MPs traded in marble and ceramics. And they were the same MPs who will send truckloads of baltagis with marble and ceramic shards to crack open our heads in the streets of the revolution. Traffic signals were burnt out and bent, and we'd wake up another morning to find the city had sprouted plastic palm trees festooned with winking red and green light bulbs, and they had really scored, not only made money, but made Cairo into a clown. We apologized to her, amongst ourselves and in our hearts. We told her we loved her anyway, told her we're staying. The day the Cairo Tower lost its discreet white uplighting and was caught in a net of flashing colored dots, I cried. They dammed sections of the Nile to create new waterfront residences, and land was sold from under residents' feet to foreign investors. Cement was poured into every public construction project, including disastrous restorations of thousand-year-old mosques. The cement factories ran on subsidized fuel and made a profit margin of 65%. In Mu'attam, the sewage from a new wealthy development on the top of the hill eroded the rock on which Duya, the old poor district below, was precariously perched and sent it crashing down the jagged hillside. The residents are now camped in protest in front of Maspero, their wretchedness displayed for all to see. A quarter of a million children lived on the streets, and some people set up shelters for them, and some made films about them, and some stole their kidneys and corneas. Police officers ran protection and drugs rackets. People regularly fell out of windows during questioning or had heart attacks in police custody. There was a video of a woman hanging upside down and begging, begging. There were protests, marches, demonstrations every day. There were flash screenings of torture videos. The top judges of the country stood for 2 hours in silence in the street outside the judges' club with their sashes and ribbons and medals on their chest. We knew then that judgment would surely come. Degraded and bruised and robbed and exploited and mocked and slapped about. My city. I was ashamed of myself for not saving her. Every one of us was. All I could do was look and listen and stay and march and insist that I loved her. And she acted like she didn't care. She unraveled with bravado every thread of that once tightly ordered pattern breaking loose. Blue and green and red and black and every shade and texture all sprung away from the tapestry in disarray, tangled, knotted, vivid, sizzling, present. The city stayed awake longer, put more people on the streets. Small art galleries opened and tiny performance spaces, new bands formed across the musical spectrum. Mosques and cultural centres clutched at the derelict spaces under flyovers. Green spaces vanished, but every night the bridges would be crammed with Cairenes taking the air. We suffered a massive shortage of affordable housing, but every night you would see a bride starring in her wedding procession in the street. Unemployment ran at 20%. And every night there was singing and drumming from the cheap, bright, noisy little pleasure boats crisscrossing the river. Last paragraph. Trees that were not cut down refused to die. They got dustier. Some of their branches grew bare, but grew. We looked out anxiously for the giant baobab in Sheikh Marsafi Street in Zamalek, for the Indian figs on the Garden City Corniche, for what my kids called the Jurassic Park trees by the zoo. If they cut a tree down, it grew shoots. If they hammered an iron fence into its roots, the tree would lean into the iron, lean on it. If a building crowded the side of a tree, the tree grew its other side bigger, lopsided. I knew trees that couldn't manage leaves anymore, but put all they had into a once-a-year burst of pink flowers. And once I saw a tree that seemed looked after, that had just been washed. It couldn't stop dancing. So that was all pent up in there, you know. That was sort of.
Well, it's very passionate, and it feels like a very long and difficult and obviously passionate story that you have with Cairo. I know I lived in Cairo for 7 months, and it's quite a difficult town to leave and to not to love, but at the same time not to hate, because it's so miserably chaotic and dirty, but at the same time so resilient and so full of life, as you describe. But I had a sense at one stage in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is, that you, with this extraordinary emotion, this intensity, that perhaps there was a degree of romanticizing, of idealizing. And in a way, I'm glad that you've structured your book in this way, because there is a wake-up call in the middle. We are back in reality.
Mm.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. I mean, I'm told that so often that I guess it must be true. But I think that's fine. I really don't see anything wrong with romanticizing something, as long as, you know, as long as you're not being actually false, as long as there is something there that that lends itself.
No, because the book is also full of observation of the not-so-romantic things, and you are constantly brought back to a very ugly reality, which is the unresolved issues that remain unresolved. I was reminded, and forgive me for this comparison, but with this very famous revolution in another very famous novel, Sentimental Education. But the guy sits in bed and does nothing. He goes and visits his mistress. And it's a book, it's a book about the inability to act, the inability to do anything about what is going on. going on. It's a very bourgeois book, and obviously it was... But you act, you sit there. In fact, there's your lovely picture in the midst of the mayhem.
Yeah, and I don't have a mistress.
I was going to ask you about that. But does it feel... How does it feel to be faced with this city that you love so much and yet be so aware of its potential to explode, to disappoint?
Well, I mean, the same goes for the whole country, for the whole region. I have felt that way about Palestine. You know, you just... You know, in the last several months, I've kind of eventually made the decision that... I mean, you're constantly... You have people sort of sounding alarms or people saying, oh, but what if, you know, what if SCAF don't go away? What if the Brotherhood do this? What if? Well, you know, I think that basically you carve out your path and you decide what you can do, and then you sort of maintain direction, because the rest of it is just, it's too big, and there's nothing you can, I mean, you can only do what you can do. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And so basically, I think we just kind of get on with it and think that we are incredibly lucky and incredibly privileged to be living at this time, which actually does truly have so much potential, and to be living at that point where we can, you know, do our little to stop the bad stuff happening.
Yeah. I mean, you have a family that has a very long involvement in, as far as I can understand from the book, a very long history of involvement in politics and in fighting for justice and fighting for independence, fighting for a better Egypt and a better Arab world. How does that compare with the history that you have inherited, let's say, from your parents and your friends as well? Because you mentioned a number of them, many of them alive, many of them not alive anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does mean that one is always in a context. I mean, we're not at all unique, sort of a bit extra high profile these days because of Alet, my nephew. But really, I think that a great many of the young people, the Shabab, who are working for the revolution, are actually the progeny of people who were in the student movements of the 70s and in the labor movements, and those again were, you know, people who were. I mean, my father's generation, my father and my uncle were both in jail briefly during King Farouk's time, and there was a moment when my nephew refused to recognize the authority of the military court. When all the family remembered my uncle, but he didn't have the support of his father. He was 19, and he was jailed. This was way back in the 40s. And his father got him, like, the biggest lawyer there was. And he turned in court, in the dock, he turned around and gave them his back and just sort of wouldn't have anything to do with the trial and therefore was locked up for a year. And my grandfather was completely furious. So it's different now that, of course, you know, people, the family is pulling together. But
it is unique in many ways because we have missed the urban, educated individual willing to go out and fight, go out and militate. I don't mean fight with arms.
No, revolute.
And it is unfortunately a shrinking group, the group of urban-based, educated, politically aware people who are willing to militate in this way outside necessarily party ideology or party organizations, as you did and as your parents did.
But there were 18 million of us out there.
Yes.
So I don't think it is shrinking. I think that for a long time it was limited. But I think that that's because people couldn't see where action would go. I mean, I'm talking about Egypt.
Yes, exactly.
That basically, okay, you had a hardcore with fluctuating kind of peripheries, who have been politically active since the Intifada, since they went out in support of the Intifada in 2000. And then after that for Iraq, and then after that Kifaya hit the streets, and various civil movements. But in say you were in a taxi going to a protest, and you talked to the taxi driver, and then he would say, well, you know, I think you're right. I wish I could be with you, but I have a living to earn, and I have children at home waiting for this money, and frankly, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. And it was probably Tunis that let people see, that came at the right moment, that we'd had 10 years of kind of things getting worse and worse, and the protests getting wider and wider, but very bitty. There wasn't a great big coalesced thing. And then Tunis happened, and showed that actually, by putting yourself out there, you might actually achieve something. And people came out.
And the future?
Oh. Well,
because you, in the midst of this very emotional and hopeful book, because in the end, you end it with testimonies by younger people, very brave younger people who had spent a lot of time Tahrir or elsewhere working for the uprising. But the fact is that the realities are very, very difficult, very troubling. You spoke about the, you know, the political future, the Muslim Brotherhood and so on, the army particularly. What is your view, and I know you've been asked this probably many times, but what is your view now, because it changes all the time?
Well, I haven't been there now for like 3 weeks. I've been following as much as I can, but I'm back on Sunday. We now have a parliament, and one thing that is for certain is that nobody who has actually taken part in this revolution is going to turn around and go home and say, actually, you know what, we're just going to settle back into whatever we had. That is just simply not going to happen.
Economic reasons are very pressing. I mean, it's a very dire economic situation. That in its own would be enough to mobilize the country.
Yeah, except, of course, that is being presented as the fault of the revolution. I mean, this sort of, you know, disinformation that the military is engaging in, which is, I mean, basically the military are following the same point-by-point kind of strategies that the regime that Mubarak was following. It's the same regime employing the same strategies to discredit the revolution and to frighten people and to divide people again and so on. But anyway, the sense of agency that people have recovered and the sense of self is just not going to be put away again, whatever happens. So there's that. Now, the revolution was there for, it had very clear objectives. Aish Hurriya Adel Ektamaiya, and within that, Karama Insaniya. So bread, freedom, social justice, and therefore human dignity. And when you unpackage these, then it is, you know, the economic situation, things like employment, that's bread. Hurriya is police brutality and repression and freedom of expression, and so on. So human rights, basically, are at the heart of this. And Adel Ektamaiya is
social justice,
which is, you know, a state where everybody can get a good education, where there is health care, you know, universal health insurance, and so on. So where there's a safety net for people who can't...
So better distribution of resources.
Better distribution of resources, a new distribution of the economic power of the country. And it's always worth pointing out that without the labor movement, without the huge strikes that have been across the country for the last 5 years, the revolution wouldn't have worked. So Tahrir and the streets, that is spectacle, and that's great, and it's PR, and it's PR for ourselves as well to kind of mobilize us and bring us together. But the real work was the work that was being done in the factories, in the shops, in the universities, and that is, no way is that going away. So the situation is that we are now in a fight with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF. Realistically, had we known that we were going to have a revolution, and if we'd been asked before it happened what we thought would happen, we would probably have said that today we would be in this exact battle with Mubarak and his regime. We wouldn't have thought that it would crumble so easily. And maybe it didn't crumble. Maybe they jettisoned him so that they could perpetuate the regime, in fact. So anyway, whatever. We are now in the real fight with the military, with the old regime. And of course, we know that a key issue is the United States and what it chooses to do and where the money goes and where the arms deals go and so on. And all I can say is that we're working on it. So at the moment, we have the revolution that is the militant revolution that is on the streets, that is to remind people all the time, the campaigns, the films. Today was Friday, Martyrs Friday, to remind everybody about the people that we've lost and the people who have been maimed and so on. And there were thousands, hundreds of thousands on the streets. So that continues. The work that is the, let's call it the industrial work, it encompasses the universities, the newspapers, and so on, basically work within institutions and organizations, whether by strikes or whether by setting up new unions or whether by trying to work out new regulations, new systems of ownership. That's another one. Another one is that people are going to court, and not just over Mubarak, but people are going to court individually over their children who were killed or maimed. They're going to court to retrieve factories and businesses and lands that were fraudulently taken. They're going to court over everything. So there's a whole push there as well. And now that we have Parliament, we have another avenue to fight through, which is Parliament. So the demand now is for SCAF to hand over power to the Egyptian Parliament on the 23rd of January. Now, of course, they think, what cheek. Of course, they're not going to do it. But it is a very real demand, and people are out on the street demanding it. And what it's doing is it's putting this elected parliament in a bit of a bind. It's going to have to show its colors. So there are some MPs who are saying, no, we let's just stay with the old timetable. SCAF have said that they will hand over power in June. That's fine. We're not ready to take power. And so the answer from the street is, well, why did you put yourself up as a candidate if you're not ready to take power? Why have you asked us to elect you? But some are willing to go this way. So the idea is to work on Parliament so that really the aim is for the dominant party, i.e. the Brotherhood, to not be able to give civilian cover to the military. Because what we ultimately don't want is we don't want to have a military government cozying up with, a military power hiding behind and being cozy with a civilian government. And at the moment, it's the Brotherhood. And at the moment, the reason why we think that they might do this is because they are used to working underground. They don't seem to have understood yet that they now have the power and they don't actually need to cozy up or make deals with, the military, that they can actually dictate terms. So basically, these are all the avenues of fighting. Who knows what the outcome will be? We are not going to stop until we get the outcome that we want.
And you have no fear or anxiety about the fact that majority in Parliament, putting aside the sort of ideological aspect, it doesn't actually have a very egalitarian economic policy. I mean, its outlook is ultra-liberal. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood has never had a very egalitarian economic policy, let alone the consequences on the cultural life of Egypt, the relationship between Muslims and Copts and the non-whatever, and the future of its relationship to its neighbors. Mm. Do you have any anxiety? I mean, I'm thinking particularly about the rumors that the Saudis and the Qataris are putting huge amounts of money into the Brotherhood and the Salafis. Egypt, as a conservative, ultra-liberal, but democratic...
No.
Egypt, not possible?
I really doubt it. I doubt it. I mean, we know that they're pumping money in, particularly in the Salafis, and
But they could say we were elected.
Yeah, they are elected. I mean, in fact, they are elected.
Yeah.
They are the parliament.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Sure. Well, what we have to do is, A, we have to work with them. In the 18 days in the square, everybody worked together. So there were young people from the Salafis, from the Brotherhood, from the ferocious liberal capitalism, from moderate liberal capitalism, from the left, the progressives, the Marxists, everything. And through simply working together in the Midan, having to feed it, to work out how it was going to be cleaned, how to organize, and so on, they drew closer to each other. And they discovered areas of common ground, and they discussed things, and they had never done that before. And they said that they had come out of it changed. So with luck, that can be replicated. I think the Brotherhood and the Salafis, they're now in power. They cannot sit around Parliament talking about questions of identity and who loves God more and who is loved more by God. They have to deal with roads, with health, with education. They have to deal with all these things. Now let's see them deal with them. Let's see what it is that they bring to the table. Let people work together. And meanwhile, everybody pushes. Everybody pushes in the direction that, you know, that they believe is right. And I guess this is how democracy works.
Well,
culturally, socially, I am really not particularly worried. Whenever they've said anything particularly stupid, there's been huge reactions against them. You know, go to any street wedding in Cairo and the whole street is dancing. I mean, how are the Salafis going to put a lid on that? It you know, it isn't going to happen. It's
right.
Fine.
Yeah. Well, I would like to thank you to end before our technological challenge with this wonderful... I'll read it out because it's short, but you say Tahrir is about dignity and image as much as it is about the economy and corruption. It hurts how much this regime has messed with our heads and divided us, blind us to the world. They say we care only about a loaf of bread, a young labourer says. We care about bread, of course, but we also care about our dignity. I just wanted to thank you because with the 18 million plus, because there are the Yemenis and the Bahrainis and the Syrians and the Tunisians and the others, really, really tried very hard and succeeded to push back some of that dignity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you very much for this very emotional book, especially for people who have a connection with Egypt. My question is about the army. Do you get any sense that there is some kind of dissent within the army itself? Their reputation has been... aligned in this past year. Do you think the lower ranks, there's any rumble that we might see?
There are two sort of like conflicting things here. One is that we do hear that there is dissent in the army, that a lot of middle-ranking officers are not happy with what is happening to the reputation of the army. And of course, we do from time to time get a breakaway group or an officer, kind of like the guy that you see in the film being carried. We know that there are at least 50 officers who are serving jail sentences now in a military jail. We know that they have on occasion made common cause with the civilian prisoners who are also there for the revolution, for, you know, political reasons, and they have protected them. On the other hand, the way that the soldiers and the officers now deal with the young people, or older people, in fact, when they're given the orders to go in and take people off the streets is incredibly brutal and is almost personal in its vindictiveness and its spite. And so there is a big question, where is this coming from? I mean, people are saying that for a very long time, the police and the security apparatus has been our enemy, but it has never been the individual soldier on the ground. يعني الأمن المركزي, the central security forces, you know, they are the enemy, but it's never the actual soldier. But with the army recently, it has been the actual soldier. So where is that coming from? That's, I think, a really important question, actually. And finally, there is, again, a suspicion, a rumor, whatever, that that because the great worry for the Supreme Council is that there should be a split in the army, something that might happen is that you might get a coup from within the army that looks as if it's a split, that looks as if it is a coup against the Supreme Council, but is in fact an engineered one, and is again a way of jettisoning the figureheads that have become hated in order to produce something which looks as if it's new, but actually perpetuate the regime. So, you know, we're in the middle of all these possibilities. Is there someone at the back? Well, let's take this until the people at the back have decided.
Yeah. No, this young man wants to ask another question.
Thank you. I went to Egypt like 3 years ago, and it was peace. There wasn't much like fighting or anything, but for example, taxi drivers were saying, oh, this guy, he's a really bad person, but the person before him was good, but it's bad now. And then it suddenly abruptly is like policemen coming, yeah, go away, killing people. So how did that happen?
Yeah. I guess this is how these things happen. It's been building up for a long time, but people have only spoken about it as your taxi driver has spoken about it. And if you'd been there maybe at another point, you might have seen a protest or a demonstration with the police surrounding it, but mostly it has looked quiet. But it was all kind of simmering away underneath, and eventually it blew its top. Yeah. There's several at the back, and there's...
Have the elections strengthened or weakened the revolution?
It depends what we do with them, really. In a way, they dissipated.
When the bombs were dropping on Lebanon, I was the media spokesperson doing
what
a
is
lot
that?
Of the organizing.
I have no idea. I think that's the laptop. It's found its voice. Just press command Q. Okay, over? Okay. So at the point when they happened, they channeled a lot of, revolutionary will, I guess, or energy into the electoral process. And in fact, when they happened, there were, a lot of activists were demanding that they be boycotted and decided to boycott them themselves. And then I think very sensibly, a lot of people, seeing that the people wanted them and were taking them seriously and there was a huge turnout, decided that you could not be an activist and be saying that the people are wrong. And therefore, you know, just kind of hold your nose and go in there and vote. And now we have to turn the result into something that we use to push the revolutionary process forward. Yeah.
Okay, I would like to ask about what do you think is the best moment to document this revolution? A lot of voice calling for not celebrating the first anniversary of the revolution since it's not yet over. We are still in the middle of it. But at the same time, we're having a lot of books, a lot of movies already done about the revolution, why it's not yet over. So what do you think, your opinion?
I think that the revolution is a process, and I think that it is fair to document it every step of the way. I don't think one can dictate really to anyone that this is not the moment to document. Celebrating is another matter. We are in a delicate position because, of course, I mean, on the one hand, you want to keep insisting that the revolution is a good thing, and so you want to be celebratory about it. On the other hand, of course, it's incomplete, and also it has been a time of great sadness for a great many families. You have, 1,200 people killed. You have over 8,000 people who have been irreparably injured. You have 4,000 people serving unfair jail sentences. And so it needs to be just, whatever happens needs to be pitched very, very carefully, so as to make sure that everybody is included. But I think that marking 1 year since it happened is very important. And I think that there are people who are doing things like across the 18 days. Every day marks the day that the year passed. And I think documenting is tremendously important. And keeping a sense of it as a living thing. Just as you would with a child. I mean, you don't wait until they grow up in order to. Yeah. Please.
Okay, sorry.
Sorry, I'm so sorry.
Do you think the American role going forward will be just as irrelevant as it has been, or the fact that they are major financiers of the army will have an impact? Do they say something in public and say something to the generals in private? What do you think about that?
I think they're bound to be saying something in private, in public, and saying something to a lot of different things to a lot of different people in private. It was a very liberating time when they were irrelevant, when we were there, and it was like it doesn't matter what the Americans think. This is what's happening, and of course now they've had time to collect themselves and to work out who to work with and so on. I think it really very much depends. I think a lot depends on what we manage to do with this parliament. Because, for example, a lot of us believe that we should say no to American aid. That basically it really is not doing us any good. And we don't want it. And we don't want it held over us. And we don't want it. It's doing us more harm than good. And it was a constant refrain in the battles where people would hold up the casings of bullets, of gas canisters, and say, this is what we get from American aid. So if we manage to, I mean, we will eventually, but will we do it in the very, very short term, that we will manage to push a government into saying we don't want American aid, that really matters. The Americans, they have to look democratic. They have to look as though they are supporting democracy. And they have to maintain, or try to maintain, what they believe are their interests. They have to try to protect Israel. How they play that is very, well, it's very important and it's very interesting. And I think that we have work to do with people there. The progressive movements, the Occupy, the Code Pink, the Not in Our Name, the Jews for Justice, and so on. These are all people who their natural position would be with the revolution and the revolutionary government, and they should be key in pressuring the American government into how it behaves.
Could it survive without it?
Without what?
The aid.
It could survive very well without the aid.
Right.
It really could. I mean, basically, there are about sort of 500,000 things we could do now to, to bring in food and bread and tourism and all the rest of it if we had a government that was acting out the principles and the aims of the revolution.
Right.
Totally.
Has there been any clamor for the Arab countries to intervene to replace that aid?
There has been by, again, the liberal capitalists, etc., but not by the people.
Right.
You know, the
there's a price to pay.
Exactly, and we don't want it. I mean, the clamor from the ground, the ideas from the ground are to do with large development projects that employ masses of people, to do with cooperation with our neighbors in Africa, to plant wheat with Sudan, for example, as has been offered many times, and the previous Egyptian government. I mean, you know, when you have the Sudanese coming and offering large tracts of land and water, and, you know, we've got these, and you give us the manpower and the know-how, and we will plant enough wheat to feed ourselves and everybody else. And the Egyptian government says, no, we cannot talk about wheat because wheat is a strategic crop. I mean, that is just so criminal. So there are, you know, really obvious things that have been waiting to be done and can be done if you have the political will to do them.
I have a brief comment and a question. The brief comment is the amazing repercussion effect the Egyptian revolution has had of all places in Israel. July the 14th movement in Tel Aviv, one of the most popular slogans were Kikar Tahrir Kan Ba'ir, which translates as Tahrir Square is here in this town, which is quite an amazing development. But the question is, this is obviously an Egyptian revolution, but at the same time it's part of an Arab awakening. What is the relationship between these two aspects? I mean, since the 1960s, after the 1960s, the idea of Arab unification has declined and has been put into disrepute. What is your perspective on this idea coming back in some new form?
I think it's always been there. I think it's declined and been in disrepute by the regimes that are in power. And I think, you know, if you are a regime that is actually trying to divide people in your own country, Muslim from Copt and Sunni from Shia and rich from poor, of course you're trying to divide the Arab world as well. But it has always been, I mean, the second song that was played in Medina Tahrir after Mubarak left, the first one was Bil Ahdan. بالأحضان يا بلدنا حلو عبد الحليم, which was, you know, embrace in our arms our country. And the second was وطن يا حبيبي الوطن الأكبر. You know, it was the anthem for the Arab nation, for Arab union. And so that's been there. And the reason why people were so glad when Nabil al-Arabi became foreign minister for those brief weeks was because he is somebody who is known to push that agenda, and indeed he immediately worked to bring the Palestinians together and to adopt on another track the popular delegations that had gone out to Africa to try and mend fences with our African neighbors very, very quickly. And so I think that the pan-Arab discourse is very much there. The young people are certainly talking to each other and have been talking to each other for a long time. They've learned things from each other. I mean, they see themselves as a unit. And to talk about simply one aspect, which is the technical, the software people, and they've created Arab Techies, which is a grouping of Arab techies with a brief to open. They exist in the virtual space now, but the brief is to open an Arab techie office in every liberated Arab capital. And so Tunis now has one, and Cairo's, and so on, Libya. So that's very much there. And that is going to change the discourse, I think.